Hello, everyone. Today is 24 January 2013. This is the first Track B session of the Ontology Summit 2013. Myself, Todd Schneider, and Terry Longstreth are the co-chair champions for this track. So if you go to slide two, please. This is, again, a reprise of our mission statement for those of you that haven't seen it. In terms of evaluation of ontologies and their uses, we're focusing on extrinsic aspects. And our mission statement is listed here. In particular, we are going to use a black box paradigm for this track. That is, how you approach evaluations of ontologies is going to be done via black box, and in particular also from a systems perspective. However, as Hans will tell us, this systems perspective may be a little too constrained. So if we go on to slide three, we listed here just a few off-the-cuff extrinsic aspects that might be considered if you're going to evaluate ontologies and their uses. And again, these are posted on our webpage, and we talked about them last week a bit. If you go on to slide four, so one of the challenges with a black box evaluation is, what exactly is the boundary of that black box? And here we are listed some of these possible boundaries. And of course, boundary is a binary notion at least. So are we doing it at the user level, at the system level, at the subsystem level, at the component level? And of course, in fact, are there other levels at which the evaluation could be considered? And in particular, what are the contexts of that boundary and or the black box? We'll hear a little more about that. So if we go on to slide five, please. We've named this session Finding the Scope. And specifically, you know, what is the scope of the evaluation in addition to whatever the notion of a black box evaluation paradigm is? So the talks that we'll have today will be a short introduction or request for evaluation dimensions. And we'll list a few of what we think these are. Then we'll hear from Hans Poelzer, a former fellow from Lockheed Martin, on the dimensionality of evaluation contexts for ontologies. And then we'll hear from Mary Balboni, together with her team, Doug Toppin and Than Van Tran, on black box testing paradigm in a life cycle. And then finally, from Megan Katsumi, a methodology for the development and verification of expressive ontologies. Now, the organization of these talks is purposeful. In particular, we're going from the very general, Hans's talk, to pretty specific with Megan's talk. And the first two talks have not a lot of direct connection to ontologies. But from the black box perspective and a systems perspective, I think what we will hear from these two talks will be very helpful. That is, Hans is going to talk about the context, as his title says, and Mary's team is going to give us a review, if you like, of the black box testing paradigm in general and some specifics regarding that paradigm in use with databases. So, if we're ready to begin, our first speaker, as I said, is Hans Poelzer. He is a former retired fellow from Lockheed Martin. He's also the chair emeritus of the Network-Centric Attributes Functional Team, which is part of the Network-Centric Operations Industry Consortium. I've worked with Hans for many years now, and I know his talk will be very interesting. So, Hans, if you're ready.
So I'm going to talk about the dimensionality of evaluation context for ontologies. If you go to the next slide, I have a little bit of an overview. I'll talk about the background and motivation for this particular presentation. I'll give you a quick overview of evaluation context dimensions as I see them, but also as a somewhat provocative instigator perspective to get people to think about what all the context dimensions are that really impact evaluation attributes and the appropriate evaluation attributes you might use to evaluate ontologies given the context in which that ontology is being evaluated. And I'll also lay out some suggested next steps for where to go from here. Next slide. So as background, the thing that I really wanted to bring across is that there's been a lot of work done in evaluations of maturity models, net-centric attributes, things of that nature. And, you know, the big tendency we have is to assume what the evaluation context is as implicit, simply because we're approaching the problem with all of that background, all of that context background already in our heads, and we tend not to make it explicit. A particular case in point was NCOIC's engagement with the DoD net-centric attributes team, in which, in critiquing that at their invitation, what we found is there were a lot of implicit assumptions in those attributes about how they would be used and evaluated. And unfortunately, the actual programs out there didn't all, first of all, that those assumptions were not explicit, and the attributes were essentially imposed on programs that didn't really share those same context assumptions that the attributes were created under. And so it became very difficult for them to apply these attributes in their particular context. And there was a lot of, I'll say, wheel spinning and misunderstanding and so forth, and also inappropriateness of the attributes for the context in which they were being applied. So one of the things we identified in the formal critique, that is the invited review, was the development of specific dimensions of an assessment context, as we called it in there, but now in this particular presentation I'm calling it an evaluation context. But out of that we came with a number of dimensions that we believe are, for the most part, applicable to the evaluation of ontologies for pretty much the same reasons that they were appropriate for evaluating net-centric attributes. So we'll go to the next slide. I did add a couple of additional ontology evaluation dimensions, which you'll see, but they're very similar to what we did for the net-centric attributes. The set of possible ontology evaluation criteria, as you will probably see in other presentations in this particular forum, are very large. And one of the things you'll find is the pragmatic constraint of trying to do an evaluation in, you know, finite time and under constrained budget and other people resources. So we want to make it clear that particular evaluations are done in particular context, and to use evaluation criteria that are appropriate to a particular context, the particular purpose of that evaluation, and to be able to select the appropriate criteria rather than trying to come up with a one-size-fits-all set of criteria that you apply willy-nilly to all ontologies and all evaluation contexts, which generally is not really a scalable, doable activity, in based on my experience anyway. So we need to make it clear that when we come up with evaluation criteria, what the expected context is in which those evaluation criteria are appropriate. Just as an example, early in the life cycle phase of an ontology, the level of detail and types of criteria would be significantly different from later on in an ontology that's already achieved an operational state is in production use. So we need to be clear that the life cycle phase will be something that is considered in what evaluation criteria are being applied in a particular evaluation. Similarly, certain attributes that you might want to evaluate an ontology against may only be measurable in certain application domains. In other domains, they're not relevant. They're not, or even if they are relevant, you can't achieve a reasonably objective measurement of that attribute. Next slide. So what are the evaluation context dimensions? I've broken them out into a number of different sets. For the most part, when I say a dimension, there are usually multiple dimensions or subdimensions to that. Todd has suggested I use the term subspace. But regardless, the top-level description of dimensions here is enterprise or institutional scope dimension, the ontology evaluation scope, the ontology application domain dimensions, the ontology lifecycle phase dimension, which I already alluded to, ontology evaluation purpose dimensions, point being that there may be a variety of particular purposes for an evaluation, and some other evaluation context dimensions that people might not think of at first blush, such as the methods and processes and tools used to conduct the evaluation, the relationship between the ontology provider, users, and evaluators, in essence, the business model for conducting the evaluation. Related to that is the issue of an ecosystem of ontologies out there and the aggregation of evaluations, you know, a consumer's reports or Angie's list of ontology users, if you like. That's what I mean by reputation or experience management. What are people's actual operational experiences with using a particular ontology, and with their relationship with the ontology provider? You know, are they getting the kind of support that they were expecting? Is it responsive, and so forth? Comparing ontologies to one another, and the consumer's reports of ontologies, in effect. There's also the related issues of what are the liability issues that might exist if someone rates an ontology in a public forum. And the other issue is ontologies in some cases may be private, or the evaluation of it may be private, and the intellectual property rights that someone may want to assert in a particular ontology, or it's in its rating or evaluation. And related to that also is this issue of looking at ontologies and ontology use over time, and what I call the trajectory of an ontology. I may want to evaluate an ontology based on where it's been and where it's going as much as where it is right now. So, and there are probably others that I've overlooked, but this I thought would be a good set to start from. Go to the next slide. Can we get the next slide?
Slide 6.
That's correct. The title of the slide is Enterprise Institutional Context Dimensions, and key point here is that this subspace provides the institutional setting and scope portion of the evaluation context. Point being that an evaluation is usually conducted within the scope of some institution or enterprise. It can be a social group, it can be a virtual enterprise, it can be political, economic, or some legally constituted enterprise or an informal enterprise. As an example, this particular forum. It often provides implicit institutional domain scope boundaries for an ontology. That is, a particular institution is created with some scope definition associated with it, typically, like a neighborhood watch or a corporation with a charter. I believe it's the primary driver for the issue of which languages, and I'm talking about human languages, but also any formal representation languages for that ontology. So if we're talking about an international context, we might want to look at ontologies that support other languages besides English. And, of course, it typically would determine the interoperability or compatibility requirements with other related ontologies. The institutional context is the one that primarily drives that. And, of course, it's also the primary driver of any regulatory, legal, privacy, intellectual property, and security evaluation criteria that might be associated with an ontology. So as an example of what I mean by an enterprise or institutional context, I'm just citing this particular forum, say W3C or NATO, NIST, ISO, individual companies, projects or divisions within companies, product lines, or industry associations like NCOIC. And we've got in NCOIC, we do have a fairly detailed set of scope dimensions that go into more detail on how to measure and characterize a particular enterprise context in a way that others can understand and compare, you know, in sort of a Venn diagram or N-space blob, the overlap that N-space blob has with some other enterprise out there, which is also an N-space blob. Next slide. So this particular dimension set is looking at the issue of how much of a particular ontology is going to be evaluated in a particular evaluation context. You know, all of it, some of it, how do you, what pieces of it are you going to evaluate? Todd alluded to some of those aspects of decomposition of ontologies in his intro. You know, do the reasoners that are associated with that ontology, would that be part of the evaluation or just the formal representation or the instance base? Is it possible to evaluate a selected subset separately? Are the evaluation criteria set up for that? And are there ancillary constructs or services that might be viewed as part of an ontology in some context? For example, ontology compliance verification services or naming services for ontology instances like issuing VINs or domain names. Next slide, which would be slide 8. And this is the life cycle phase dimension. I say it's only one dimension here, but I think there may be additional subdimensions in certain contexts. But basically, we're looking at this issue of following and evaluating ontologies from the earliest, you know, conceptual development, identification even of a need for the ontology, all the way through ontologies that are out there in production, used daily, and possibly even end of life being phased out, although that seems rather unlikely in the case of ontologies, at least for most of them. Some examples of the values for this dimension would be early on, the need for and scope of an ontology has been developed. A little further down, some portion of the formal representation of the ontology has been developed. And going a little further, the formal representation is complete. And then the ontology may be populated with instance data. Reasoners have used the ontology to achieve real-world results, and so forth. And I'm showing this as kind of a waterfall life cycle model, but recognizing that there may be overlaps in steps and you may be using reasoners earlier when the ontology is only partially developed and so forth. In fact, you could do a co-development. But in any case, where a particular ontology is in this life cycle phase dimension will drive a number of the evaluation criteria. Okay. Next slide, which would be slide 9. The application domain dimension, this is really getting at the extensional aspect of attributes, but intentional attributes are involved here as well along this dimension because what's intentional and what's extensional isn't really cut and dry. That is, it's not a binary condition. And which intentional attributes are important may depend on the extensional attributes that you're and the purposes of the ontology that you're attempting to evaluate. So some other application dimensions are ontology application types. How are you going to use this particular ontology? Is it going to be used to drive, some kind of software generation or system builder? Is it being used to generate data queries against some knowledge base and so forth? Which applications domains does the ontology address? How big are those domains? Is it just one domain, or are there subdomains? Does it handle multiple domains? How do you decide what is a domain? How much of a particular domain does the ontology cover? And who are the, I don't want to say authorities, but what are the sources of domain knowledge that would be used to come up with the evaluation criteria for ontologies in that domain? And a related issue is, what are the related domains that users of the ontology might reasonably be expected to encounter? Because in most cases, systems that use ontologies don't operate in a vacuum and encounter other systems and people who use different ontologies. So that may become, that may drive you to add additional evaluation criteria related to, and constraints on the ontology related to how this ontology will interact with other ontologies out there. Next slide, which would be slide 10. The evaluation purpose is an interesting dimension in that most people come at evaluation engagement with a specific purpose in mind, but they tend not to be very explicit about what that purpose is. And so when you are evaluating something for a particular purpose and aren't explicit about that, others may not interpret your evaluation properly. So it helps to be explicit about what the evaluation purpose is. And secondly, the evaluation purpose will drive specific evaluation criteria. And any particular evaluation may have a multiplicity of purposes as well, so you need to consider that. As an example, the decision to invest in further development of an ontology. So that might be some kind of, life cycle review, like a design review or requirements review. Product line plans and supply chain interoperability strategy may be part of the purpose of doing an evaluation. Or reviewing an ontology for regulatory compliance is another example. The overall evaluation breadth and level of detail is going to be driven by the purpose of the evaluation. So you need to be thinking about how extensive this evaluation is and what attributes in the evaluation context are going to justify and drive that particular purpose. One of the points here is that there's got to be a rationale to justify investing resources in evaluation. So that's going to drive how detailed and comprehensive the evaluation might be. You need to consider that in selecting the evaluation criteria and the appropriate processes for conducting the evaluation. One point I'll make here is that a broadly based or broadened scope ontology will generally merit more investment in evaluation because presumably it's going to be used by lots of people in lots of enterprises and related domains. But one of the problems in that case is, how do you justify the expense in that the benefit accrues to many people, but the cost would typically accrue to only one. That is the group doing the evaluation. So the business model for how that evaluation group gets funded to do the evaluation is an interesting one. And of course, you could use, an open source or crowdsourcing kind of model for doing that. But for a lot of domains, there's little justification for that. That's why I say the business model for investing in an evaluation becomes an issue. Next slide, which is slide 11. And here's some other evaluation context dimensions that people might not consider at first blush. I touched on these briefly in the earlier slide. But certainly evaluation process methods, tools, and services are something that needs to be considered. And of course, it depends on what the nature and intended use of the ontology is. So you may have requirements for formal certifications in domains that are, safety critical or heavily dependent on or financially significant, like banking systems and so forth. You need to consider those aspects in the evaluation context and how those will impact evaluation criteria. I mentioned the relationship between ontology providers, users, and evaluators. So the ecosystem and business model for the different players in producing and consuming or using ontologies. The issue of aggregating evaluations over time, not just looking at each evaluation as an atomic event, never to be used or seen again, which is typically what happens inside a particular enterprise. And, of course, that raises the question of exposing that evaluation outside a particular enterprise context and the privacy or competitive advantage or intellectual property concerns that might exist when exposing experience outside a particular enterprise boundary. And related to that is the issue of comparability of evaluations. Do we have a global standard for evaluating and rating ontologies that would allow a rating of an ontology by Group A to be comparable to rating of another ontology by Group B? This is one of the issues that the CMMI folks had in terms of policing the consistency and uniformity of software process maturity rating. And, of course, the liability issues associated with that, as well as privacy and intellectual property rights. Evolution history and trajectory of ontologies, thinking about ontologies and ontology evaluations over time, and how that itself is an evaluation criteria or potential evaluation criteria. And then how do we assess compatibility or interoperability of ontologies with each other? Can we come up with a rating system for doing that? And then related to that is ontology translation and mapping services. If you don't want to do or bear the cost of making your ontology work with another one out there, could there be a provisioning for third-party rating conversion or mapping services? And one of the things we've learned is we always include an other in this dimension set, in that we'll probably never be complete in looking at all the important facets of ontologies and ontology evaluation attributes. Next slide. So this is my suggestions for future work with the forum and any interested parties, specifically looking at any additional ontology evaluation context dimensions beyond the ones I've identified already, or maybe a recasting of the ones I've identified already. Fleshing out all of the subdimensions that are implicit in what I just went through, and developing associated scales that would reflect some, natural attribute value breaks, tick marks, if you will, along the dimensions. And then more importantly is to categorize the ontology evaluation attributes as to which applicable context dimensions they operate under, and value ranges in those dimensions, and of course vice versa. That is, which ontology evaluation attributes fit within which context dimensions. And lastly, consider the impact of evaluation context on evaluation processes and tools. So, depending on the purpose of and the institution in which you're developing the ontology, you may want to consider using automated tools or more workshop-oriented tools, or workshop-oriented processes. If you're doing automated generation, you probably want to have automated tools doing things. But if you're looking at ontologies that deal with human social institutions, or maybe even things like medical terminology and so forth, you may want to consider more human-centered evaluation approaches. So that's it. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, this is Terry. Thanks a lot, Hans. Todd will come back and give us what was essentially his opening slide set that we inadvertently skipped. So, Todd, why don't you go ahead? And of course, throughout the presentation, as Todd will mention, we're happy to look at your chat stuff. We will capture any salient chat items in our web page later on.
Okay, thank you, Terry. I'm sorry for the oversight, but following Hans's talk, I think this is also an appropriate time to talk about this idea. So I'm assuming that these slides are showing, the title being, oops, got to find the right set here.
Yeah, the slides are up. Should be the one Schneider deck for everyone who's not on the shared screen.
Okay, the title is Evaluation Dimensions, A Few. So if we go to the second slide, please. Again, this is a recap of the mission statement. And if we look at the first sentence there, the goal is to identify gaps, practical and theoretical, in the evaluation of ontologies from a systems perspective. However, in order to identify the gaps, it would be good to have some idea of what it is we're doing in the first place. So if we go on to slide 3. So in order to aid this subject of ontology evaluation, which, as described, is fairly new, but, of course, the evaluation of software and systems has been going on for many decades now. But in order to aid this subject that we're calling ontology evaluation, I think it would be very helpful if we started organizing a list of what I'm going to call evaluation dimensions. And just as Hans was using this notion of dimension, I'm using it here also. And in developing this list, this simple categorization, and again, it's a simple-minded categorization at this point, we want to help clarify what some of those gaps may be, and in particular the differences that ontology evaluation may have with respect to, say, systems evaluation or software evaluation, provide a basis for describing viewpoints for the evaluation, or in Hans's notion, the larger context of the evaluation, understanding the evaluation contexts based on the dimensions that you're using, and be able to map these with or extract from existing paradigms. So if we go on to slide 4, right here is a real simple-minded list of some of the evaluation dimensions. And yes, I've already started some categorization. Now, bear in mind that these dimensions are not independent from a mathematical sense. You know, you take the dot product and get zero of whatever the metric you're using. No, that's not the case here. There is dependencies among them. Exactly what those dependencies are might be a very interesting subject for discussion itself. So some simple-minded evaluation dimension, say from a systems perspective, is performance. And, of course, then there's all types of performance. You can think of CPU performance, network performance needed, but if that comes into play. Inferencing performance, if you saw in the chat box, we were talking about how reasoners can be used as part of an evaluation tool set, but they themselves, from a systems or a larger perspective, could be a subject of evaluation themselves. How well do they perform? And as we all know, to date, unfortunately, one reasoner is not equivalent to another. And then what was suggested by Mike Ushold is the notion of a user evaluation dimensions. Is it correct from a user's perspective? And Hans pointed this out, too, in terms of certain terminologies. And one thing I brought out last week I want to mention again is in a system that's using an ontology, there may be a mechanism to introduce either new concepts or relations into the ontology itself or perhaps more regularly, instance data. And in terms of evaluation, it may be necessary to have a separate evaluation of that mechanism because perhaps the implementation of the mechanism to have an ingress method for instance data is itself not correct. So that would have to be checked. And then there's this notion of domain completeness. Now, I don't want to get into the distinction of completeness with respect to logic and reasoning and so on, but from a user's perspective, and perhaps from as Hans pointed out, the enterprise context, have you represented your domain with sufficient degree of fidelity? So this is certainly an evaluation dimension that is of interest. And, of course, that could be confused with this next group I put up here called adequacy in terms of coverage. Have I covered the domain or domains adequately? And have I covered them correctly? Modeling is just that. It's not the real thing. And in modeling something or other, there's a noise factor that goes in that translation process. And now another aspect, which I don't think has been talked about much at all, Hans briefly mentioned, is security. Does the use of an ontology or the ontology itself or its infrastructure provide an attack mechanism or profile? And an analogy would come to mind is SQL injection. Now, I don't think I've read anything or heard anything about looking at security aspects of ontologies or their uses. That itself might be a new research subject. I don't know. And, of course, evaluation dimensions are cost. How much does it cost to develop, integrate, test, train people to use it, operations, blah, blah, blah. And then legal aspects that Hans pointed out. So if we go on to slide 5, we would like to ask the community to contribute to this list. So as we go through the various sessions of the summit, we'd like you to add to this list of possible evaluation dimensions. And to do this, for this session, we'd like you to post your suggestions on the chat box, and we will collect them. But also, and I forgot to put it in the slides, is we have a community page for our Track B, and I have the URL posted, where we would like you to add your suggestions directly. And hopefully we'll get a very good list, and then we can discuss how to organize it. And that itself, we know, could take quite a while. So with that, I want to go on to our next presentation by Mary Balboni and her team from Raytheon. They're going to talk about black box testing paradigm in the life cycle. And again, this is not necessarily ontology specific. They are going to give us a review of some of these basic principles, paradigms, and methodologies that are currently used for other things, in particular predictive bases. So Mary's going to be presenting the slides, but her team was herself, Mary Balboni and Than Van Tran. So Mary, if you'd hit star 7, and as you advance the slides, please tell us which slide number you're going to. Mary?
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're coming through. Can you talk a little louder?
Yes, I can. I'm real close to the phone, so I'll... Can everyone hear me then?
Yes, this is good.
Good? Okay, great. Well, I want to thank Todd, who I've worked with years, for inviting me and then my team that I got together to the summit. And he's just an inspiration of dedication and hard work. I just really am inspired, and I hope he's been inspiring everyone here. If you go to the next to the chart two, this is just sort of some of the items that I want to cover with this black box testing paradigm and the title of this presentation. We're going to look a little bit about one chart on the life cycle of where the black box testing usually fits in. So thinking about black box testing as an operational on an operational system is sort of the focus, and we'll go into some examples, and we'll also responding to Todd, this is assuming that the paradigm of an ontology exists in a black box, which would be similar to large databases that exist in a black box. And so that's one of the reasons I brought Vani Chan in, because she's a DBA, and so she can, contribute some of the large database issues to that part of the presentation. So on chart three, just really simply, just to clarify, I'm sure everyone's seen this, but I just thought I'd put it in here, the difference between the white box and the black box testing, where the white box will be more the internal correctness of the quality of writing code, for instance, and the correctness of that. And, just like it says here, are we building the software right or correct, which would be glass, also called glass box, and it's the verification. If you've heard of V&V before, this is the verification part. And the validation, it would be black box, because in the black box, of course, you don't see the inside of the code. You're validating the big picture, and you're looking at functions, behaviors. These are all requirements in our system engineering world. So that's what we think of the black box is the testing of requirements. I think Hans previously might have indicated like a test criteria, and we think about this as the test requirements, system level requirements. So let's go to chart four. And I put together this picture of where does it fit in the life cycle. I hope this is not too much of a surprise to most folks, but white box, you're usually in the front end. You have some low-level code design. You're doing unit tests. You see everything that's inside the code, and you can test it. It's usually the programmer testing their own code. I've been there back in the 80s as a programmer. And the black box, white box overlaps during integration phase of a life cycle. Now you're looking at the combination integration of high and design and low-level design to try to integrate them. Usually you're building one part of the system, a CSCI or something along those lines. And when you get to high-level design, you have whole functions that cross multiple CSCIs, and you're testing that in a black box. And typically in this life cycle, the system requirements happen after that, and you actually only test per the system requirements, high-level system requirements. And acceptance tests, of course, now you're either in the customer's environment many times, or you might be getting acceptance tests in your own environment before you send it off to the customer's site. And they are basically selling off requirements so the contractor can get paid, but it's basically typically a test of contractual requirements. And beta is like ad hoc testing after it's been delivered and updated. And along somewhere in here in this life cycle, usually after functional, maybe some integration functional, you might be doing some regression test in the black box paradigm too. So I sort of made it kind of clear that sometimes white and black box testing can overlap, but we're going to focus on that black box testing part of this of the life cycle. Okay, let's go to chart five. So I put together a question here. How does it apply to large database systems? Because we're trying to think about that paradigm that an ontology in a database could be considered very similar. And we're talking about, we'll talk in a little bit, a couple of slides from now about the more modern databases that are not so isolated like an Oracle database, for instance. But basically, in a black box paradigm, you're knowing what the data that you put into the system and the databases and what the expected results should be. This is not testing if the database is actually storing data, the input in an appropriate table, for instance. It's not what it is. And database testing is the act of validating the contents, the schema, functionality within the database. And when you think of the schema, you're actually trying to validate the behavior of that schema, not the actual content of the schema. And if caching is involved in the testing, you must also test the cache controls and expiration tests. Okay, so that sort of talks about how it would relate to a large database. So how would we validate using black box testing? Go to chart 6, slide 6. Again, in typical large database testing, what they would do is test using a replica of the original database, sometimes called sandboxes. You would create a database test based on either rebuilding the existing database or starting with a new creation. You'd identify your test data, you'd develop tests based on the system requirements, and then you'd execute and check the results. And again, I have a slide on the more modern databases that talk about distributed data and data rules in cloud structures. Okay, the next chart, 7, I go a little further, and I say what's included. What's included would be tests for error conditions and degraded mode operations, load and capacity testing. This is what Todd just alluded to with the performance testing that on his criteria he was talking about. There are useful tools in test environments in an SOA or, could I say, Doug, SOA or cloud here? Okay. So either SOA or cloud, they are there are test environments you could use. Going back to there are lots of test tools and environments and platforms that you could use. And also if you're having multiple systems ask actor sharing testing in your black box approach. So one thing on chart 8, I hope I'm not going too fast, but I'm wanting to get through, I have a little bit more slides than normal, 20 slides. I wanted to talk about, well, how well can we measure the completeness and goodness of this kind of testing? And, well, even if it's not black box testing, but about, you know, most of the black box testing is what we do in system engineering before we deliver a system in general concepts, is we look at the predicting latent defect factors. This may be way out of the ontology discussion, but when you develop things, you want to know, well, when should I stop testing? When is this good enough? And you are basically collecting defects along the way. And the Rayleigh curve, I have a reference there, and this is just pure input for people, for thoughts. There's tools like SEER, SWEEP, and they all use this kind of curve. And the industry standard is during the development phase, which is the lump, the dinosaur back of the curve, you might get 30 to 85 defects per 1,000 lines of code. But your latent defect, when you want to deliver the product, you want to focus your measurements, you know, your predictive tool to say, well, now we only have about a half of a defect or maybe up to three defects in 1,000 lines of code. And most systems I've worked on, our goal is to have one defect or less per 1,000 lines of code delivered. And tools like SWEEP, I've used SWEEP for the AAS program back in the 90s with the air traffic control systems, for instance. And so that would be it actually would be a government requirement maybe on a program to have these predictors in there. And if you can say, you know, you've done all your testing and your estimations say that I'm doing a one defect per 1,000 lines of code delivered, then you're probably pretty complete in your testing. Also, like Hans and Todd both referenced, you're probably pretty complete in your testing when your money runs out, too. So that's another part of real life. On the next chart, 9, just another, we were talking, and this came up in discussion. I think, Todd, you had this on your chart. There are some specialized quality checks, and maybe just to see, well, how good quality is the testing that's going on. The goodness of the testing. And you can actually plan for defect injection or defect seeding techniques. And this is really interesting. I really don't know how this would affect ontology, but it's an interesting thought to think about. How effective are the testers and the kinds of things that they miss? So what the idea is to go back and ask developers or authors of those applications, databases, whatever, to inject known defects. So you keep a list of them. You just don't put them in there, and that's part of the delivery. But and then you go and turn it over to the testers and see if they can find, if you put in 10 bugs, 100 bugs, did they find 5, or did they find all 100? That kind of helps you see how the goodness of your testing is as well. And there's another concept that if you do this defect injection, it might even help you find even more anomalies in your code than if you're just checking code and there's no defect in there. That's a really interesting concept that bears more study, I think. So this is another concept that I'm kind of presenting of how you might find out how good is your testing. And I sort of like this idea. And, of course, you have to have some financial support of this. If you're in a tight contract, this may not be something they can do. But I think this is one of the most effective things you could possibly do to determine how good your testing is. On the next chart, which is chart 10, we talk briefly about these more modern distributed data, small fragments of stored data on nodes. So I want to pass this chart. Can I pass this to Doug? I don't know if you can talk across the table there. Just briefly about modern databases and the testing that may or may not exist for it.
Well, one of the aspects of, I guess, modern day is probably not the best term for it, but the main thing is different databases in the sense of getting away from RDBMS and moving to databases that are distributed across a variety of hosts, potentially in a different environment, different geographic locations, failover aspects, replication, and so on. And all those things do influence the testing process. I'm not sure how applicable that is from an ontology perspective as much as an implementation and correctness perspective, but these things are particularly important. And I think one aspect of NoSQL specifically is that they're not necessarily what you'd call mature compared to RDBMSs in general. And as a result, there are potentially or even likely omissions in configuration, conceivably in the code itself, that open up opportunities for security problems, for example, or reliability problems in the way that they're put together. So I think this area is particularly key, is that until you establish enough institutional knowledge within your organization on what it really means to test in a different environment than previously or different applications, it takes greater care, and best practices have not necessarily been established in a way that makes sense or at least are well known. I should say that probably is better for a NoSQL type database. So NoSQL is just sort of a specific case, but I think if you think in terms of cloud architectures and so on, all those areas influence the way that testing has to be planned and executed and evaluated.
Okay. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks.
A lot of good thoughts there. Just to be aware that we're in such a modern growth area that we still don't have a lot of answers to how to test everything. So I'm just going now back to, let's go to chart 11, now just to think about, well, what's sort of standard in black box testing, and this could help with generating ideas and how it could relate to ontologies. But in generally in black box testing, like on chart 11, we talk about testing data rules. And these are pretty straightforward. If you've been in software for any length of time, the equivalence partitioning, when data can only be in certain partitions, for instance, less than 100, 100 to 999, and greater than 999. So there's three different partitions that data could be. So you'd have to test that they are in their partition. Just a concept. And the boundary analysis, everyone's heard about this. This is very key. I've seen when this is not tested and things get by that it's kind of affecting your whole system. But if you have a boundary of 100 and then 99, you really need to test one out of the boundary and one minus one and plus one, for instance, if it's a numeral, just to make sure you cover the boundary top and bottom. That makes sense, but that's basically your boundary analysis.
Mary? Excuse
yes.
me? Before you go on, could you say what partitioning means?
Oh, this is not partitioning of like your data or your space or your CPU or anything. This is like a concept of a number is between 100 and 999 inclusive. So that means you have to say the number 50 would not be in there. So that would be that's outside of the boundary or the partition. So your partition is your data rule would define what your partition is, and then your partition would be having to be tested if it's you're in an, or out of that partition or that boundary. I'm sorry if that does that make any sense?
Well, the relationship between the data testing rule and a notion of a partition helps clarify things a bit.
Okay. It's really, really simple. That's probably why you're thinking it's more complicated than it is.
Okay, sorry to interrupt.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Okay, on chart 12, let me go to chart 12. There's also something called validate the data quality by the testing rules, and this is what can data be and or not be. For instance, in a column, everything in that data could be a flavor, it says, but their default would be strawberry, for instance, and the value existence could be a start date and an end date that gives it a range. And the size rules would be how many characters or max of a character. So it could be all these data rules would apply to the data in the database. They call them columns, but it doesn't have to be a particular column. It could just be that array of data. So that's some testing rules based on different things than numbers. And then there's a lot of automated tests that can run continuously to determine if these tests are all passing. Chart 13. This is called CRUD. In large databases, they use the CRUD terminology. It's for each user transaction and operation is performed. So the test, you have to see if that test is actually working inside by looking at logs. So if you do a create a transaction or a save transaction, you're actually doing a create operation. And so this is sort of like a terminology they use in the database world. And they would check to make sure that if an action happened, a transaction happened, that a specific operation happened in the database. The next chart is 14. And then I like this validating relationships or referential integrity. This is when you have your database and you have your business logic, like what should it do, what are the constraints, triggers. You're not actually looking into the code, looking if a trigger changed from 0 to 1. You're actually looking at how the business logic was implemented and to ensure that it works accurately. So you're testing what is expected from the system or the database based on business logic rules. And I was thinking, I hate to stay theoretical, but the best example, so when I was trying to bring it down to have an exact example, is I go to my banking system and I say, well, would you please send me an email when my account gets below $200? Now, that's a business rule I asked them to implement. And so the test is, you know, go out and spend money and see if my email shows up. And so that's an example of testing a business rule and how everything is the triggers, the constraints, things like that. That's probably the majority of where your system functional requirements would be sitting in. The next chart is chart 15, and validate performance characteristics. This is back to performance, back to requirements. What's the requirement of your system? I don't know if you have performance requirements in ontologies right now, but I know wherever ontology is sitting, in whatever system, the system must have some performance requirements. And these are things like required time ranges of things that need to be done, how it works under load or stress testing, and the basic database impacts to the system. So I found I was thinking of how can I talk about this? I'll give you some examples. An airline ticketing system will have a higher performance requirement than, for example, the civil community driver's license system. Huge differences. And also, if you've ever driven on the roads and you have one of those toll collector systems in your car, a little box in your window, they have really high performance requirements. You know, recognition and quickly check to see if there's any money in the bucket and then take the money out. That has to be like split seconds. So that's an example. And all of that has a lot to do with the data collected and database sources. Okay. The next chart is chart 16. There's another term for database transactions called ACID, A-C-I-D. These are well-known terms for these properties of a database transaction itself. And, atomicity, is that a good way to pronounce it? You know, I'm sure everyone finds words that everyone pronounces differently, and I do that a lot, but that's the way to do it. This basically means there's no partial transactions left. You either do it or you don't do it. There's no partial transactions. Consistency is basically a transaction of one kind. One kind of transaction has the same outcome. For instance, if you want to do an update in a database, it doesn't delete one time and then update a different time. It always does the same action. Isolation is whether you can do a transaction one by one and have it work properly, or whether you can do all these transactions simultaneously and have them all work properly. They all should work properly no matter what. And durability is just once the transaction is committed that it sticks. So these are some kind of interesting things to think about in properties-wise. Maybe they relate to ontologies. And then chart 17. Can any of these methods be reused? And like I said before, assuming that the paradigm of an ontology is the same as a database in a black box as an ontology in the black box. And I think they could if you have defined requirements for each of the following. Then you validate each of the following. So everything we just talked about, data rules, referential integrity, the relationships, the performance and the properties of a transaction, if you set up requirements for these and then validate them in a black box, I think that these kind of methods can be reused or something along these lines. And I wanted to leave the presentation with some thoughts on security. This is really a hot area on chart 18 starting. Security everywhere is getting to be hot cyber. You hear about it everywhere. And the key thing about black box testing is that it is not a suitable alternative to security activities. It's an effective way to validate systems, and they can very much help security by catching errors and security issues, as we mentioned in this chart. And I'll just go quickly to the last chart. Chart 19. These are some concepts I dug up about what would an attacker do. If you're testing for security, what would an attacker do to my system? And so these are some things. Our world in delivering large systems, we also worry about accreditation that the government requires as well. So this is could be hand in hand with that. But if you don't have systems that require that, these are some things to think about, maybe put into that list that Todd wants. Fuzzing, this is basically a random generator of data. Just like, you know, like if you go and say to a tester, just break it, try to break my system. They just do random inputs. Same with syntax testing. It's just a random, put some test syntax together, may or may not be true, just put it together and test. The other one, exploratory testing and fault injections, you want to spot anomalies with this type of things. We talked a little bit about this with the fault defect injection, and they can be very helpful. Data analysis, I mean, that's what system engineers do, but in the framework of the security, you're trying to look at the system and the data and analyzing how it works from the point of view of an attacker, and it really brings a new way of thinking of your tests. Let's see, the monitoring, the behavior, referred to observability. This is really interesting because you can monitor behaviors and just kind of consider it with a new set of eyes. Could this be a vulnerability on the system we haven't seen before? And so you could put in a name, for instance, and see if first you go in and store a name, then you try to retrieve it. The behavior would be, give me the name, but if it doesn't show up or a different name shows up, that's an anomaly. That's a vulnerability. That's bad data integrity. So also at the observability, you also might want to see about only certain users should be getting to the data. You might have some control aspects on your database that, should have been banged out in testing, but if it doesn't, you can also do it by monitoring the behaviors of the system. So that's pretty much all the data and presentation materials I have, and just a little chart on the people that we've put this together with myself, Doug, and Bonnie Chan. We have some good experience, and I hope it helped a lot.
Thank you very much, Mary. That was a very nice talk, and you've raised a lot of issues that I think we can apply directly to the ontology evaluation.
Terry?
Yes, Todd?
In the instance of time, I think we need to forego questions until after Megan has given her presentation. I don't want to shortchange Megan.
I was about to say the same thing, but good.
Okay.
Let's go.
And, I wanted to point out that originally I had just asked Mary to give me a list of people with expertise in databases, and then she turned around and developed this wonderful presentation. And from an ontology development perspective, I think her notion of injecting errors is quite intriguing, given the fact that it's really easy to, shall we say, not model things correctly. Okay, but going on. So our next presenter is Megan Katsumi. She's a PhD student from the University of Toronto in the Department of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering, and as you might suspect, she is a student of Michael Gruninger's. So Megan is going to give us something very specific. As I said, the title of this session was Finding the Scope, so we've gone from the general, and now we're going to get down to the specific. And the title of Megan's talk is A Methodology for the Development and Verification of Expressive Ontologies. So Megan, if you would, and please tell us the slide number when you change.
Okay, thank you. How's the volume for everyone? Is it okay?
Yes, it sounds good. Great.
Okay, great. Today I'll be presenting some of the work that I did for my master's thesis. So if we can move to the next slide, slide two. I proposed a methodology for the development and verification of expressive ontologies. And so this material is specifically relevant for track B of this year's summit because it addresses the issues of requirements and their verification, as well as how evaluation can be used both to revise the ontology's requirements and also to make corrections to the ontology. So if we can move to the next slide, please, slide three. So the methodology that I proposed was motivated by some of our experiences in developing first-order logic ontologies, where we found that existing development methodologies didn't really adequately address the challenges that arose with their development. And so that was specifically related to the expressiveness of the requirements and a lack of verification guidance. So when ontologies are more expressive, there's this potential for deeper semantic errors, and things like simple consistency checking aren't really enough. And although there has been work towards more expressive requirements with things like competency questions, when we're developing an ontology, we're still faced with this second issue of a lack of verification guidance. So a lot of existing methodologies will discuss this issue of error detection, but they ignore the issue of error correction. So if we can move to slide four, please. To address the challenges on the previous slide, I proposed a development methodology for the design and verification of expressive ontologies. And these phases aren't very different from those in a lot of the familiar software development methodologies, but in our case, in the design phase, we're developing the actual axioms for the ontology, and then the requirements for specifying the ontology's intended models using entailment problems. Then in the verification phase, we use the results of the requirements and the design phases to determine if the ontology that we've designed meets the requirements that we've defined. The tuning phase at the bottom there is something that's a little bit different, and we use that to attempt to address the potential ambiguity in the verification results, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. And lastly, the application phase just represents the eventual implementation of the ontology. So moving on to slide five then, to help illustrate some of my remaining points, I'll be using the BoxWorld ontology as a running example. So BoxWorld is something that's available on Colore, and it was designed to describe two- and three-dimensional shapes for potential applications in computer vision and manufacturing. BoxWorld uses relations like point, edge, and surface to specify the domain, but for simplicity, we'll only be considering the two-dimensional shapes, and we'll refer to the axiomatization of this as T-surface. So at this point, you can already think of a bunch of different shapes that we might want to describe in this domain, and these are all shapes that we intend to be models of the ontology. So moving on to slide six then, at the very earliest stages of ontology development, we'll go through a lot of iterations between requirements and design, which we refer to as iterative refinement. And at this point, we're really creating more of a prototype of the ontology. We're kind of brainstorming axioms and then reviewing their models with an automated model generator. So initially, this model generation might be undirected, but eventually we move towards what we call a directed model generation, where we're attempting to generate models of specific sizes or with specific properties. And we're doing this to gain a better understanding of the types of models that satisfy our axiomatization. So this helps us to kind of understand what we want and what we don't want for the ontology. And in this process, we can sort of start to recognize the general characteristics of our intended and unintended models. So then through iterative refinement, we're revising our informal requirements or the ontology to reflect this improved understanding that we have. So moving on to slide seven, please. These are two examples of two-dimensional shapes. The first one is a model that you could imagine we might want in some manufacturing domain. So it's just a flat surface with five edges and five points. The second, however, the star shape, intuitively that seems like a model that we might not want. There's five edges, but there's edges intersecting each other at multiple points, and this doesn't make too much sense if the model is supposed to represent a two-dimensional surface. So in the process of refinement, model generation helps us to identify these cases, and then by analyzing the resulting models and deciding which ones we want and we don't want, we can start to recognize and specify these general characteristics that we want and don't want for the ontology that we're designing. So this process kind of lays the foundation for the formal specification of our intuitions about the intended and unintended models for the ontology. So if we can move now to slide eight. So for a little bit more on intended models, this is further illustrated in this figure from Nicola Guarino, where you see we have in the darker shaded area the set of intended models or models that we want our axiomatization to have. But in reality, the models of the ontology's axiomatization may include some unintended models or exclude some of the intended models. So any instance of such an unintended inclusion or omission really corresponds to an error in the semantics of the ontology. So to specify what we call deep semantic requirements, what we really want to say is that the darker shaded area of the intended models represented here should be the same as the lighter shaded area of the models of the ontology's axiomatization. So if we can move on to the next slide. So we're at slide nine then. In our methodology, we do this with what we call semantic requirements. So these are used to specify the conditions that any model of the axiomatization is also an intended model, and any intended model is also a model of the axiomatization. And then moving on to the next slide, slide 10. Something that's unique about these requirements is that we can formulate them as part of an entailment problem with the ontology and possibly a domain theory and the antecedent. So we can formulate them in such a way that by evaluating this entailment problem, we're actually verifying that the ontology meets the requirement. And this is, allows us to use an automated theorem prover to evaluate the requirements in the verification phase. So next slide, please, slide 11. So the challenge of the requirements phase then is to recognize the characteristics of the intended models so that we can formalize our intuitions in the form of these entailment problems. Now, in the ideal case, we could completely characterize the intended models using some kind of well-understood mathematical structures and then use this complete characterization to generate the entailment problems. So, for example, in the box world ontology, we recognize that the intended models of T-surface were equivalent to the models of cyclic graphs such that edges in box world correspond to vertices in cyclic graphs, and the arcs correspond to a pair of edges with the additional property that two edges meet at a point. But then, so moving to the next slide, slide 12. But oftentimes, especially in early development, we won't possess a deep enough understanding of the intended models to achieve this ideal specification of requirements. So in our methodology, there are other ways to specify the requirements that partially characterize these intended models using the entailment problems. And one way you can do this is with competency questions. So these are queries that the ontology must be able to entail, and in, even if the intended models haven't been completely identified, as in the previous example, they can be used to specify required properties, such as the characteristics that we might have identified during refinement, as well as the necessary level of detail and indirectly the required performance with a theorem prover. So moving on to the next slide, slide 13. For an example, in the box world ontology, we might recognize the characteristic of two-dimensional shapes that in T-surface, every edge should meet exactly two distinct edges. So we could then specify this characteristic using the competency questions that an edge cannot meet another edge at two distinct points, and that every edge meets at most two distinct edges. So you can already kind of see how the specification of this characteristic would exclude some of the unintended models. So for example, the second competency question wouldn't be proven from T-surface if the star shape shown earlier was a model. So moving on to the next slide now. So we're on slide 14. So in the verification phase, when we're evaluating the requirements with the theorem prover, our methodology provides guidance for each possible outcome. So these outcomes are kind of the driving force behind the whole process as they dictate what must occur next in development. So the most straightforward case is when the requirement is verified, and in this case, we can either proceed to verifying the remaining requirements, or if they've all been verified, we can proceed with the application of the ontology. But we identified two other cases where the ontology does not satisfy the requirement, and then based on what is encountered in each case, earlier phases in the ontology's development will need to be revisited. So moving on to the next slide now, slide 15. The first case is what we refer to as an unintended proof. So what this means is that when we're evaluating a particular entailment problem, the theorem prover finds the proof, but it's not actually a proof of the requirement that we were trying to entail. So what this indicates is either an error in the design of the axioms or an error in the specification of the requirement. And we can determine the cause with an examination of the proof output and the axioms that were used. So next slide, moving on to slide 16. An example is when we were trying to verify one of the competency questions that we presented earlier. We found a proof when trying to verify the competency question that every edge meets at most two distinct edges, but when we actually examined the output, we realized that it was actually a proof that there does not exist anything that is a point. So obviously this is an unintended consequence of our ontology, so we had to return to the design phase, and when we reviewed the proof output, it allowed us to locate a mistake in one of our axioms. So it actually turned out that the axiom shown on the screen here was incorrect, and if you move to slide 17, you can see it was just missing the last equality at the end. So now moving on to slide 18. Case 2 refers to the case where no proof is found. So in other words, the theorem prover kind of times out when we're trying to verify a requirement. And this indicates that one of the following situations must be true. So either a theorem prover cannot find a proof because, in fact, no proof exists, and this means that either the requirement that we're trying to prove is stronger than we had intended, and so it should not actually be provable, or the ontology is weaker than we had intended it to be, and so it's unable to satisfy the requirement. Alternatively, it could be the case that the requirement is provable, but for some reason the theorem prover is having difficulties producing the proof. So now if we fail to find a proof, sometimes we can use a model generator to search for a counterexample, and so the existence of this would show that, in fact, no proof exists. But if we're unsuccessful in doing this, then the cause of our inability to verify the requirement can be pretty ambiguous. So moving on to slide 19 then. For example, in the box world ontology, we were unable to find a proof of the competency question that an edge cannot meet another edge at two distinct points. The cause of this problem was ambiguous, but we had to kind of rely on our intuitions as well as our knowledge of the ontology's development history to help us determine what the cause was. And moving on to slide 20, in this particular instance, it was actually the case that we're unable to find a proof because no proof existed. So, and that was because it was consistent with the axioms to have a model like this one where you have two edges meeting each other at two distinct points. So in this case, for the ontology developer, it's a kind of design decision. So should we revisit the requirement stage and relax the competency question to allow this kind of a model? Or should we revisit the design stage and then strengthen the axioms and eliminate this model so that we can entail our original competency question? So now, as I mentioned, one of Boxworld's intended applications was in manufacturing. So when we considered this, we realized that we might actually want to have a model like this one. As you can imagine, if you were to make a single cut in a piece of sheet metal, for example, you might want to describe the shape with the model shown here. So moving on to slide 21 then. If it had been the case, on the other hand, that we were confident that there was a proof and it was just that the theorem prover was having difficulty producing it, we would have proceeded to what we call the tuning phase. So this refers to either the addition of lemmas or the use of subsets to help improve the theorem prover's performance with the entailment problems. So when we talk about lemmas, we're referring to them in their traditional mathematical sense, so as some consequence of the theory, which is in our case the ontology, that can be used as kind of a stepping stone to help us prove some goal, which in our case is the requirement. So just for a brief example of this, in some of the work that we've done with process ontologies, there was an ordering relation that had the property of being transitive. This property wasn't specifically axiomatized by the ontology, but it was a result of the axioms. And during development, there were a bunch of requirements that we're having difficulty producing proofs for. So they would time out, or they would take something like 10 minutes for the theorem prover to find a proof. But with the addition of a lemma that explicitly stated the transitivity of the ordering relation, we were able to find proofs for a lot of our requirements in like less than a minute. So subsets, on the other hand, this is a technique that kind of approaches the problem in the opposite way. So sometimes large ontologies can actually slow the theorem prover down because there are so many axioms to reason with. So by selecting a subset of the axioms, we can sometimes improve theorem prover performance in that way. So now moving on to slide 22. In summary, I proposed a methodology that was aimed at addressing the major challenges that I saw of developing expressive ontologies that aren't considered by existing lifecycle methodologies. So it prescribes a rigorous specification and verification of semantic requirements, and also includes some pragmatic guidance through the development phase, most notably in terms of the outcomes of verification. And this approach also takes the semi-decidability of first-order logic into account, but I want to note that it's not restricted to use with full first-order logic ontologies. It's also been used effectively for a variety of ontologies here in Toronto, including one for sheet metal manufacturing as well as the PSL. So moving on to my final slide for today, slide 23. So the methodology that I presented would really be improved if it could be augmented with future work that might focus on ontology quality as well as requirements validation and certainly a lot of other topics that will be covered in this year's summit. As well as some of you might have recognized, our approach for early ontology development leverages the use of an automated model generator. So this requires that the ontology that we're developing has finite models. So a point for future work should focus on addressing the challenge of prototype design and iterative refinement in the case that there are only infinite models for the ontology. And the last point, in the case that the ontology will be implemented as part of a larger system, I think it would be a worthwhile point of investigation to also look at how we can use the use cases for the actual system to help us identify SMID requirements for the ontology. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Megan. Todd had to leave. We have quite a bit of time left for questions and discussion. Does anybody want to start the questions? Fabian? You got your hand up.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, good.
Great. Megan, thank you. I have a question about your semantic correctness criterion. It seems very, very strong because you want basically to match the models of the axiomatization or the models of the ontology with the intended models. And now, even with if you have full first order logic, that's hard to do. You know, assume you want to describe a factory or, you know, a company. One intended situation is certainly that the number of employees in the factory is finite. You won't be able to axiomatize that, for example. So the point I'm trying to make is that even if you have an intention or an intended model, or you might not be able to characterize that in the ontology language that you're choosing. That's certainly already true for first order logic and even more true for less expressive languages like OWL.
Hi, sorry. So, it's not necessarily that you have to characterize all of the models with the requirements. So with the competency questions, I'm not saying that you necessarily have to be able to represent all of the aspects of the intended models. But also another point is that if you can recognize that a mathematical structure or some other theory that sort of represents the same models that you want your ontology to have, we can kind of characterize that relationship using elementary equivalence and test it that way. I'm not sure if that...
Well, I just think your notion of semantic correctness is too strong. The assumption, I mean, the underlying assumption here is that our ontologies, we have a set of intended models and we are able to axiomatize to a level that we can exclude everything which is unintended. And I think that's even theoretically not feasible and even less practically feasible. I mean, for, you know, on a complex ontology of a complex domain, you will always be under-axiomatized.
Well, I don't think that necessarily means that the criteria for semantic correctness is wrong, because if your ontology does include or exclude some unintended models, then, you know, it's not entirely correct, you know, according to what your intentions are. That doesn't necessarily, like, so I guess even though you can't, you may not be able to prove that an ontology is semantically correct with my conditions, but I think that they're still accurate.
Yeah, and Fabian, you know, we agree that, you know, of course, if you have a requirement that says all of your intended models must be finite, then, of course, those intended models are not going to be, say, first-order axiomatizable. But that's going to, in a way, when we rely on a kind of an approximation of the intended models, using, say, competency questions, then very often, you know, there can be these models that maybe are not isomorphic to your intended models, but because they're elementary equivalent to the intended ones, they don't really cause any difficulties when you're doing inference.
I'm just saying that your definition is, I'm not saying that your methodology is wrong. I'm just saying that you're basically overly restrictive with your definition here. That because what you just said meant you're basically making compromises because you know that you won't be able to axiomatize down to the intended models. But okay.
No, that's true. It definitely, you're right. I mean, there is a question of compromise. So there will be certain, I guess, requirements then that would not be axiomatizable in your particular ontology language.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Megan, I kind of had a question. I'm following up, I guess, on what Fabian and Michael were saying. I didn't understand exactly, but was it the sense that there are only parts of the ontology that you can cover with your axiomatization, with your methodology rather? Your requirements only cover part of what might be a larger ontology.
I would say that the requirements maybe only cover kind of part of what your real requirements are for your intended models, maybe sometimes. But in terms of I'm not sure what you mean by covering part of a larger ontology.
Well, maybe that is what I mean. I think you
so like you mean like well, I mean, you could evaluate parts of the ontology in isolation, like when like if you have different modules or if you're looking at subsets or something like that, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, I was just wondering if I could use your methodology to test a large complex ontology, the gene ontology, something from a bioportal perspective. I'm just kind of wondering where we can apply your notions.
Modularity.
I would say that it would still be applicable. But you know, in some cases, if you're going to be looking at a really huge ontology, then you're going to have to either rely on its modularity or kind of extract subsets for yourself to be able to actually perform the reasoning tasks.
Okay, good. Thank you.
But I think it still applies. Yeah.
So, are there any other questions?
Yes, Peter.
Peter, yeah. You've got your hand up.
Yes, a question for Megan. The presentation was wonderful. I can see the method, one specific feature of the methodology, I guess, which sets it to be different from, let's say, the testing of a database, is that your introduction of fine-tuning in maybe making the ontology a better ontology through the testing and evaluation. So my question, as I had put down on the chat, I noticed that, I mean, you sort of do the fine-tuning through the verification, do fine-tuning with design and requirements, but you have this one single arc to application. I mean, would you consider maybe during application we might still find opportunities for fine-tuning that goes back to maybe correcting the design or the requirements?
Yeah, definitely. I guess the diagram is a little bit oversimplified, but especially so like the tuning techniques that I talk about and even sort of the cycling back through design and requirements, I would expect a lot of that, much like with software, that would continue after the ontology's application as well. So with things like lemmas and things like that, you could sort of apply those techniques if you wanted to get maybe better performance for a specific reasoning task. And then also if, you know, a mistake is found in the ontology after application, you would still want to go back and revisit the requirements and design, much in the same way that you did in the verification phase, I think.
Sounds great. We're in sync. Thanks.
Thank you.
So, Peter, I guess I can hand the floor back to you. It doesn't look like we have any more questions. I don't have a wrap-up chart, but I'm going to go through the chat and try and create a workable summary of the items that we collected on our web page.
Sounds great. Is the original intention of Todd and Terry was to also use the opportunity to get some real-time feedback to the evaluation dimensions. Quite a few has already been posted to the chat board already. So I'm bringing up Todd and Terry's chart number 4 again on the evaluation dimensions, and maybe give everyone a few more minutes to suggest additional dimensions that they can find applicable. That way, Todd and Terry would call these inputs and make a more comprehensive chart. So maybe in the next couple of minutes, look at the chart one more time. Are there dimensions that you feel strongly that would be useful in sort of adding to the seed attributes or the seeding items that's already on Todd's chart or were already added to the chat board now? I notice Leo has a question, has a remark to make. So Leo, star 7.
Yes, I made a comment about slide 4, precision recall and also coverage correctness. I think currently precision recall are under query, which is fine. So I think these are also probably going to come up in the intrinsic evaluation aspects next week, maybe with a slightly different interpretation. So I suggested to Todd and Terry that their notion might be something like precision recall with respect to, let's say, a given domain and its requirements.
Yes, I think that's fair. But I also think that we probably should have a meeting sometime to decide which of the things that are going to be in our list really should be intrinsic now that, rather than extrinsic.
Well, it may be that, you know, in some sense, for example, coverage or correctness, they're partially intrinsic and partially extrinsic, and perhaps the same for precision recall. So it's just an additional, you know, indexing into requirements.
Maybe there really are three subdivisions. There's extrinsic, intrinsic, and hybrid.
Well, yeah, I don't want to introduce a new track, that's all.
Yeah, no, I don't either.
Jack Ring, were you trying to say something? Jack? No?
No, I was.
Okay, then don't worry.
Leo, you still got your hand up.
So.
Okay, sorry, I see that Till had a comment on my comment, so perhaps Till has a question.
Till, star 7. Well, while Till Moskowski, you have a question to an earlier question, so if you unmute, let's hear that. And
yeah, can you
hear me? And Caius have a question. Yes. Go ahead. we can hear.
So I'm not sure what Leo meant. That I have a question to which earlier question? Sorry.
This is Till, right?
Yeah.
Till. I just saw that you had commented on further dimensions, consistency and correctness with respect to other things like intended models.
Okay. So I just mentioned these dimensions that you have. Correctness is on the slide number 4, but you could also have correctness in the sense of Megan's talk. But also consistency is, I think, a very important requirement, which is not on the slide, because if an ontology is inconsistent, then it's not of much use. Of course, if there is one intended model, it's consistent. And then completeness could also mean that you have a certain set of intended logical consequences that should follow from the ontology. So these are some kind of logical dimensions.
Maybe more appropriately for Leo, Megan has a question for you, and she says she's not understanding your question.
Okay. I'm not sure which. Let's see, which question, Megan?
Question?
So you had a question. Oh, let me find it now. Where did it go? About multiple requirements.
So some of this gets to granularity, right? So for example, if you in a blocks world, you can map that into, you know, maybe a two-dimensional world, but another requirement might be to map it into, as is normal, a three-dimensional world or four-dimensional world. So it's a notion of what if you have multiple requirements that have to span dimensionality? So it's a matter of, really granularity here, I think.
I don't think we really addressed that with our methodology.
Okay.
There's a question from Ais Daman. I got that name right?
Sounds right. Do a *7 on your phone pad and try your voice first.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Very good.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question about, like, things. In this track, we talk about a lot about the evaluation, like, dimensions. Like, and also, like Mary talked about the black box methodologies. And I'm asking, like, what kind of, like, what exactly do we need to, like, are we building the detailed evaluation techniques for the ontologies? Am I clear?
The question is the following. Like, we talk about testing our ontology or evaluate our ontology. So what the criteria of building the evaluation is this one.
Right.
Terry could answer, and then Michael Gruninger, who sort of is general chair for this entire summit, can give
because,
us his thought
sir,
on what we're, where we are trying
now.
To go.
If everyone has his own understanding for ontology, but without a standard for building the evaluation, everyone will come with different answers. So which one is right, which one is wrong?
Well, that's part of our problem, really, what we hope to solve, or at least hope to begin to approach in these series of meetings. We don't know that there is a single answer because there are so many ways that ontologies play. So,
yeah, and Michael here. Terry's definitely right. Like, what we want to do within tracks A and B is to identify all of the different criteria and properties of ontologies, all the different techniques that are being used to evaluate ontologies, I try to gather all those together, and we're doing those both through presentations such as today, but also in terms of gathering kind of a giant bibliography of say research papers and other kinds of implementations. Now then those two are intended to feed into the other two tracks, one of which is, I guess as you were alluding to, how do we kind of integrate all of these different ideas together into some coherent methodologies? And then the fourth track, track B, is actually then saying, well, how do we make all this work? You know, how can we support this with software? But again, like track C is trying to get, how do we make all this work together in terms of we can, you know, if we follow these techniques, if we use these different criteria for evaluation, you know, can we come up with methodologies that will kind of ensure that the ontologies we build do have these properties that we want?
And I wanted to advertise my presentation in that context as well, which is that the evaluation context is really the driver of the determination of which attributes and which methods are most appropriate in a given context.
That was Hans, right? Hans Pulser?
Yes, that's correct.
Hans.
So we want to be explicit about that, so and get some guidance to people as to which processes and which attributes are most important, relevant in which context.
Right. Steve Ray?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the point that I think we're talking about, you know, what to test, but I think it's how we can perhaps maybe or more easily categorize it as, you know, how you test it. And if you look at the chat, Mary and I were discussing like her bug injection. And I think if you test for bugs that were injected, you know, trying to find them now, if you look at it by, you know, traversing a schema, model, database, what have you, looking for those bugs according to a number of structural rules, let's say, then that's white box or intrinsic testing. But if you try and uncover the evidence of the bug by actually testing performance with a number of controlled questions or something, I'd call that the black box or extrinsic testing. That's how I put it in my own mind. I don't know if other people agree with that, but I think that sort of helps.
Yeah, that's good. Fabian?
I'm a little bit worried that we will have a hard time to bridge the scale of things we have been talking about in the next weeks. Because, you know, if you look at the list of things that are on Hans, you know, part of Hans dimensions, which are, you know, context dimensions, that is, I mean, that encompasses a huge number of things, you know, up to the legal requirements or, you know, then afterwards we've seen Todd's list of dimensions, which is really more properties of the ontology, while the one was about the context, which leads to requirements, which you then might be able to test of the ontology. The Todd's list was closer to things which were directly testable. And I'm not sure whether Todd's list is even close enough to enumerate all the things which might be relevant if we go back to Todd's list, Hans' list, and, you know, because Hans mentioned so many different things that might influence the way you want to evaluate the ontology. So I'm wondering whether just trying to get comprehensive lists is the right approach, or whether we can have a way of focusing more on a more tractable subset.
Well, I agree with that. This is Hans. I think it's okay to have limited scope. In fact, it's necessary to have limited scope in most contexts. And the issue, though, is to get people to be explicit about that limited scope so that you have truth in advertising, if you will. That is, we've developed methods and processes for evaluating ontologies in this limited set of contexts. And once you say that, then you are okay to go and just, you know, play around in that particular sandbox. It's when people make
assertions that a approach to evaluating ontologies is valid in, you know, all possible contexts out there that you run into trouble.
Good point. Okay, well then the challenge, I guess, is to find a good either consensus or a good criteria for the context we should focus on.
Right. And so that depends in part on the community's interest. What do they consider to be most important? Let's focus on that aspect of evaluation context first, recognizing that there are all these other context variables that could influence the results of what we produce.
Yes, and any context set that we choose today, we have to be able to extend or modify or mitigate in the future.
Or at least recognize how it might be have to change or be extended.
Fair enough. Yeah, we've only got about 2 minutes left by my clock.
Yeah.
You want the last word?
Kind of addressing Fabian's point. I think it's not necessarily the case that we have to come up with whole new kinds of criteria. We're not, this is not necessarily a greenfield situation. I think that there's a large body of practice that's been building up within the community. And so if we could really, focus on the criteria and the techniques that people are actually using in practice now, on ontologies that they have been building, on ontologies that they've been using, on applications that they are building, that is more tractable than, say, coming up with trying to brainstorm on all possible criteria and all possible techniques. I think if we focus on what we are doing now, and we're using the summit as a way of synthesizing everything, I think that would still be a tremendous benefit, because then what we can do, another kind of practical implication of the work that we're doing in the summit, would be to kind of give guidance when people are writing papers about ontologies, submitting it to conferences and journals, to say, like other sciences, other engineering disciplines have particular ways. If you're in science and you're submitting a paper to Nature, you have to follow a certain experimental procedure, and there are experimental criteria for that. And if we can, out of this summit, if we can come up with similar criteria for evaluating ontology, like in a research paper, that would also be a tremendous benefit to us.
Almost a benchmark.
Yeah.
Well, great closing remarks. So this is it for today. And same time next week, Leo Oberst and Steve Ray will be presenting Ontology Summit 2013 session number 3, which will be the first session of Track A, the intrinsic aspects of ontology evaluation. So look forward to everyone being back here again next Thursday. Talk to you all then. And thank you very much to all the speakers, which gave great presentations today, and everyone who were here and contributed to the dialogue. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.